thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities Podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's September 2021, and this is episode 251, which is a spoiler-filled conversation about the recent film Coda, which is about a deaf family and is available to be streamed on Apple TV+. On this episode, I'm joined by Cole Burgett, who is a recent seminary graduate. He is also a graduate of the Moody Bible Institute, and he is an author for the website Christ in Pop Culture. Cole has written an online exclusive film review of Coda, and it's called Growing Up and Letting Go in Coda. And you can access it for free on our website, equip.org, if you are a subscriber to our journal. So to read this review and subscribe to our journal, also go to equip.org. Cole, it's good to have you on.
Always a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, this particular film that you reviewed for us is a film that is unique in that the main protagonist is a deaf family. So obviously, it's probably not something that all viewers would relate to. And so did you particularly find it difficult to think through, okay, what is the Christian going to get out of this particular film because it focuses on a family with disabilities?
Yeah, no, I just in approaching the film, I really didn't have any trouble with it. I read that something like 40% of the dialogue, I think, was in American Sign Language, but the closed captions were effective. I didn't find it very difficult to approach the movie at all. It was just a bit like watching a foreign film. I think it also helps that the acting is really tremendous, so it's easy to, I think, get into it. I think in my review, I said something like there's not a bad actor in the movie, and there really isn't in my estimation. But as far as the deaf aspect of the film, I think in this day and age, it's really hard to find someone who hasn't at least encountered a deaf person somewhere. It seems like, you know, just in watching, you know, on news channels or something like that, any type of address, there's always a translator present. So I feel like there's at least a cultural awareness of it. So in that sense, I think the film can probably speak to someone's experience with the hearing impaired. I know in my own life, I really haven't actually met too many people with this disability. But when I was growing up, one of my dad's best friends was a guy named Craig, and he was deaf. And watching Coda, watching the deaf characters interact, that was very much like the memories I have of Craig, who was he was actually killed in a very tragic car accident some years ago. But for the relatively small time frame in which I knew him, he really left a bit of a lasting impression. My dad will still talk about him. So in that sense, no, I didn't find the film difficult to approach or too foreign a thing. And yeah, I think a Christian can watch it and certainly be okay.
I think it's interesting that this film comes along in the past year when another film that kind of talks about somebody going deaf, The Sound of Metal, also, which was had some Academy Award nominations, has been out. So it's kind of, you know, put some highlight into the people who struggle with hearing impairment. But, you know, as with any of our film discussions or television series discussions, this will be spoiler filled. So if you're somebody who likes to see something first before coming to review, you might want to stop it and then come back to this. But I want you to tell us a little bit more about the story. I feel like that this film does a good job of making these deaf characters relatable and, you know, likable. And as you said, it's no small part to due to the actors who in real life are actually deaf, some of the main characters. And so what do you think it's about this particular film that has resonated with people, you know, despite the subject matter? And what kind of set the scene for us? What is the story really about?
I think part of what you've said, I think The Sound of Metal, I think that's the title. And then the other big genre film that has come out. I mean, I think this one is certainly what you would call a dramatic comedy or what they call dramedy. And I'm thinking The Sound of Metal was a drama film. I'm not really sure. I didn't see it. But the other big genre film that is out now, A Quiet Place, that deals with a deaf character. So there's a bit of a cultural moment for these kinds of actors that I think certainly this film comes along at the right time, if that makes sense. But I think the thing about this particular film that has made it a success, the novelty of the approach to the material is one thing. And that's what all the press is about, right? The fact that this movie features so prominently deaf characters played by, as you pointed out, deaf actors. So that immediately puts it in something of a category all to itself, or a category that, you know, has slim pickings, as they say. but more than this, I think it has a lot to do with the film's approach to its story. Now, something I learned after watching the film, it turns out Coda is an adaptation of a French film from 2014, I think. Don't quote me on that date. So I'm not entirely sure how much of the story was set in stone beforehand. But the story of Coda is really a kind of coming-of-age tale. And this is the tension between the filmmaking and the marketing and the unwieldiness of the press, right? Because Coda isn't really about deaf people. It's about this girl named Ruby, played by Emilia Jones. This girl who comes from a deaf family, who has a really remarkable voice and who loves singing. And it's a very classic story in some ways. You can actually remove the deaf parents and insert any old working class set of parents who are wary of their daughter, you know, chasing her dreams, as we say, leaving the nest, all that stuff. And you can just change the setting a little bit and you can have the same kind of coming of age tale, pretty much the exact same story following the exact same beats, without losing any of the emotional resonance or what makes this seem so familiar to us. So in that sense, the movie has an immediate widespread appeal because anyone can follow that story. They are familiar with that narrative. The fact that the film simply utilizes deaf characters helps it to land a little differently. There's an old adage in Hollywood screenwriting that says 80% familiar and 20% different will get your screenplay sold. The same, but different. And that felt very, very true with Coda. From plot to character types, it is 80% familiar. The 20% difference is simply that their lead characters, many of their lead characters, are deaf. And so I think it's a film that comes about at a point culturally that is the right time for a film like this to get noticed. And I think it tells a very timeless, very classic story in a way that is the same but different. And that has helped it sort of win widespread appeal.
I think, too, by the focus of particularly the fact that this main character, Ruby, is hearing while her family is deaf, her brother and her parents, it means that as a young child, she has very much had this responsibility placed on her to really help her parents and her brother navigate through the world, through the hearing world. And it is flipped because it's, you know, a child, not a parent, but that kind of dynamic is really true for any family that has a child with disabilities. Let's say it was the parent, not Ruby. And some things that are scary to them to actually, you know, think about what it means to have independence away from your family when there's so much reliance on them, whether it's a parent thinking about a disabled child in their future life, or in this case that you said, the 20% that's different, an able-bodied non-disability child with parents with a disability who lean so heavily onto her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's very clever, and I don't use that in a bad way. It's a very clever approach to the material. In one of the, it might have been a review, it might have just been just a commentary on it, but the word that the writer used, and I wish I could remember this article now, was it sort of reboots the coming of age genre by sort of flipping certain things on its head and doing it differently. So the same but different. So you're absolutely right. It's very clever in its approach to the material and almost subversive in a way that makes it feel very fresh, even when the storyline is something we've all encountered before and are we'll always encounter again. It's very timeless in that way. So it's a good blend. It's always a winning formula when you can do a timeless story in a new way.
So specifically in your review, you talk a little bit about, you know, the difference between a movie about deaf characters and a movie that features deaf characters. Can you kind of unpack what the difference is?
Sure. This is where I think maybe film marketing is full of these brilliant people who like deceive us into watching their movies. So all of my expectations for Coda, having watched the trailers and seen a little bit about the press surrounding the film, were that this was going to be a film about deaf characters. And so I went in really anticipating, and this is just me being honest, I went in sort of anticipating this very preachy tone, this kind of finger wagging that we are so used to Hollywood producing, the whole insert marginalized group name people are people too message. And that's not a bad message. I'm not saying that's a bad message. It's just humdrum. We sort of expect it. We know what's coming. And I was very surprised that that is not what Coda does at all. When the credits started rolling, I was a little disappointed. My first reaction was a little disappointment because I didn't feel like I got what the film was trying to do. I had to think it over for a few minutes. I mean, don't get me wrong. Some of this stuff is in there and that's fine. But I was expecting some type of like massive sign language manifesto at the end, lots of dramatic music and crying type stuff. And that's really not what happens. You get that really quiet scene where she's singing and her parents are in the room and she's before the judges and she begins to meld the sign language and the singing, which is really, really a brilliant scene. But it's not the kind of, again, the preachy sort of thing that I was expecting. So Coda is not a film about deaf characters. It is very simply a film that features deaf characters. The characters themselves did not have to be impaired at all. Again, the story could have worked in a million other circumstances. The fact that Ruby's family is deaf is not the thing the movie is about. It's just the circumstance used to tell the story. Now, it's critical to the plot, sure, but it's not the thing the film is, in a sense, built around, the narrative drive of the story. So the movie isn't this preachy kind of thing. While I found that jarring at first, I ended up actually appreciating it. And in a way, I actually think this helps us to take these actors, like you said, all of whom, the parents and the brother, are themselves deaf, more seriously. It's an honest-to-goodness acting gig that has full-blooded characters that just happen to be deaf. And there's a real difference between the two, I think. And I think it's an important distinction to make.
You're listening to the Postmodern Realities podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal.
Did you know that we are running a contest for a complimentary subscription to the print edition of the Christian Research Journal, which of course gives you access to our online exclusive articles like this review about Coda? But you might not know about it if you are skipping our informational sections. So I wanted to let you know, could you please help us out and be entered into this contest? Specifically, the people who are entered into the contest are the ones that are giving us a written review on Apple Podcasts. Apple Podcasts these days is the primary way that podcasts are reviewed, even though there are other sites on which you can receive your podcast. But even if you get them at another place, would you please go onto Apple Podcasts, search for Postmodern Realities, and write us a short one sentence or two sentence review. And by the end of this year, on December 31st, if we have 100 reviews that starred or written, all the people who have written a review for us by a sentence or two that have done so since July 1st will be entered into the contest. And we thank you for that. The other thing you can do is help us out by subscribing to the Christian Research Journal. A subscription is $33.50. Head on over to equip.org. And with that subscription, you also receive online exclusive access to these various articles that are not in our print edition. So thank you for the ways in which you partner with us. And now back to episode 251, which is a conversation with Cole Burgett about the film Coda.
So I just wanted to get a little bit more into the film itself. So in your review, you talk specifically about the character of Leo, who is the brother of the main character, Ruby, and his perspective as a character being probably the more interesting one, even apart from, like you said, the familiar tropes of her coming of age. Could you kind of explain why you think his particular character is interesting?
Sure. So Leo, played by Daniel Durant, is Ruby's older brother. And I thought that he ended up with some of the most interesting development in the movie because he had more interesting conflict. And it really did center on his being deaf. So Ruby's major conflict is like the song, you know, should I stay or should I go? and staying, of course, is represented by her parents. And the going would be, you know, to college to pursue her singing career as represented by her teacher. Leo's conflict is a little different, and we never really get to see it pay off simply because it's not his story. And you're right, I bring this up in my review. Leo works with his father on their fishing boat, and he kills the off-time hours swiping through Tinder. He's a bit girl crazy. But you get a few of these really interesting scenes with him. One is where he goes out with some of these other fishermen, and it's sort of like his attempt to fit in. And they're all sort of just sitting at the bar, laughing and joking, and he's just watching them. And they are completely oblivious to the fact that he can't hear their jokes, he can't get what they're laughing at. And later in the film, he gets into this argument with Ruby. Now, as part of the plot of the film, Ruby functions as the translator, the go-between for her parents and the people who don't know sign language. And Leo's position on this is basically, well, those people should learn to deal with us rather than our parents depending on you. And I think that's a very interesting position to have. There's a lot of anger there that creates some really interesting conflict, and I was drawn to that probably just as a screenwriter and a storyteller. I'm drawn to those sources of good and interesting conflict. And my point in bringing that up is to say, you know, we've talked about how the entire film is very familiar. The plot is very familiar. The characters are very familiar. You could just substitute any type of character in. They didn't have to be deaf, and the story still works. Leo was the one character who, to me at least, didn't feel like a stock character in this particular coming-of-age tale. And I think that's why he stuck out to me. He had, it's not to say these characters were underwritten, they were written really well, and it does what it does very well. But this was the one character that sort of defied archetypes in some ways, and I thought his conflict was really kind of interesting, and he had a really unique perspective on certain things.
You know, it's interesting because I did read a piece about this particular, about these actors, and the particular actor that plays Leo. And it's kind of almost, you know, makes you think when you watch the movie, because you think, well, besides particular movies about deaf characters, what could a deaf actor actually ever be in? I mean, you know, when you think about, hey, and even kind of, you know, the beats of this story, it's like, should you really pursue dreams that are so limited? Like, what, how could you ever have, you know, A, it's hard to be an actor. B, you're a deaf actor. How are you going to support yourself? How are you going to be able to, you know, function in your craft or whatever? And so that was something that wasn't lost on me just in reading about it. I mean, yes, they've gotten some really strong reviews for using deaf actors in this film. As a matter of fact, you mentioned the French film that it's based on. In the French film, they used hearing actors that learned sign language for it. And in this one, they actually used deaf actors. So I thought that was really interesting. And then also just like you said, him trying to navigate life with not understanding outside of his family. It's like their own little ecosystem, because they live in this working class town and they're very, you know, not understood, this working class northeastern town. And it's not really understood their situation and their disability. And it's kind of like The Sound of Metal. You mentioned you didn't watch that one. I actually did see that one. And through the process of the main character becoming deaf, you go through that with him. And there's parts that just sound off or garbled. And then in one scene in this particular movie, in Coda, she is giving a recital and her parents want to come and try to support her and they're there and they really can't appreciate it. I mean, they look around to the audience. Oh, are they clapping? Oh, we should clap. Oh, there's my daughter. and all they hear is, and then you hear what they hear, which is nothing. You see all this stuff, but you can't hear anything. And so just in that moment to just kind of go through what they're going through. So it is really interesting just to think about how that character develops, and in it also how he, the character himself, feels, I think, a little frustrated with his sister, that she's kind of looked to the person who could have leadership in the family, not him, even though he's the big brother.
Yeah, there was some good tension that developed between them in that regard. And that's part of their argument. And maybe I missed this, but this is just how my brain works. But I don't know that that was ever resolved between them. And I think that's kind of interesting that they chose to leave that sort of unresolved. They have their big blow-up argument. And he's, what he says to her is really interesting. He's angry at the fact that she is very good at singing, but she's almost willing to throw that away to be a crutch for her parents. And in a way, he's like the voice of reason in that moment. He sort of comes cutting through everything and more or less tells her she's a fool if she's willing to give up all of this and these opportunities that she has in order to stay back and be a crutch for her parents, when he knows that he's capable of running the business, that just because he's deaf doesn't impair him from being able to function and run the business well. And I thought that was a really interesting source of conflict between them. And it really is sort of an interesting wrinkle that most people, I think, who don't, it's certainly people a wrinkle that people who have never been in that situation are probably not just going to think of. It's a very complex kind of, you can understand, you know, being the crutch for your parents, but maybe not in that way. And that's what's interesting to me.
You mentioned that, you know, this has beats of a typical coming of age story, basically between Ruby wanting to, you know, pursue singing and kind of the, I don't know, obligation she feels, I guess I would say, to stay home and help her parents who are trying to start their own business away from particular fish auctioneers who have kind of held the community hostage by, you know, kind of controlling all that. They want to become independent, you know, folks selling their products to people. And so that takes some navigation where, you know, for instance, in one scene, they have an interview with a local TV station, but she has to be at rehearsal. And if she leaves for rehearsal, then she can't help her parents and they need somebody to be an interpreter. And so it's interesting. So why do you think this kind of conflict still resonates with people? I mean, you know, like you said, well, it's a cliche coming of age, but yet still here's this, okay, this young kid wants to do something and the parent doesn't think it's in their best interest to pursue a particular career, for example.
Yeah, it's the age-old tale of separating from your parents. I think I titled my review Growing Up and Letting Go or something like that, because I think that's really what these coming-of-age films are all about. Growing up, the loss of innocence, coming into your own, discovering your own voice, in this case literally, and figuring out how to develop a sense of agency about yourself. It's cutting the cord, so to speak. And it really is, for most of us, I think, the most formative times of our lives. And if you're fortunate enough to have good parents who are in a solid marriage, I think you come out pretty well adjusted for the most part. And if you're not that fortunate, well, then there's therapy for that. And I'm not disparaging that. That's not a glib comment. I sat through several years of therapy wherever I could get it. And I think it's something everyone could benefit from. But I think these kinds of stories resonate with people because it deals with that period of life. My favorite film of all time is actually a coming of age film. I've watched this movie probably more than any other film in all my life, and that film is Rob Reiner's 86 classic, Stand By Me, which stars Richard Dreyfuss and a bunch of current stars who were then very young, like Kiefer Sutherland and John Cusack. It also has a very young Will Wheaton and River Phoenix, the younger brother of Joaquin. And River was really kind of an acting prodigy, a bit like his brother, and you see glimpses of it in that movie. So yeah, I think these kinds of movies resonate with everyone. I think they wield a very unique and special kind of power in literary circles. They're often called Bildungsromans. It's a genre all to itself. And you don't really have to worry about not understanding coda or being able to follow the movie if you don't really know anything about American Sign Language, because it's sort of built on a tried and true genre that is inherently resonant. That's what makes it timeless, because everyone, no matter what your circumstance, is going to go through the experience that Ruby goes through. What is interesting about the film is that it's not what you would call a common circumstance. It's not a kind of circumstance you see often portrayed on screen, and that's what makes it interesting. But everyone is going to go through, to some degree, what Ruby goes through, trying to separate from her parents, and that is what makes these films so resonant, I think.
So kind of to have more of a focus on, okay, I guess some of our listeners would be, so what does that mean for a Christian worldview? You know, and I think, like you said, can people see themselves in these circumstances? And I think for young people and for parents, you know, is it okay for, from a Christian worldview, as we think about just growing in Christ and discipleship, how do Christian kids separate from their parents, and, you know, parents allow their children to be separated from them, especially if we, let's say, replace this deaf family with a religious family of any kind of religion? You know, what does it mean to, it seems scary to want to pursue something that's so different outside of the norm of what, you know, is expected. Like, for instance, religious or not, going to conservatory, music conservatory. I mean, immediately it's like, well, what would you do with your life if you did that? What would be your job? Would you, you know, as parents think through those kinds of things, how do you relate to reconciling something that seems so different in terms of vocation and just growing up and loving your family, but also becoming your own person?
Yeah, I think there's a balance, and we have to, I think, start with, by understanding the tension. The tension is completely normal. It's completely natural. Everybody's going to feel it. It's not that weird. But at the end of the day, should children separate from their parents? Well, I mean, absolutely. I think it's necessary. It's implied very naturally in Genesis 2:24, you know, a man leaves his father and mother and bonds with his wife, the two become one flesh. And that verse becomes hugely important for later biblical writers in the justification of one man, one woman in marriage, for example. So if the question is whether or not I think it's biblical, yeah, it's absolutely biblical that children separate from their parents. The question is just the degrees of separation. And I think that's different for every person. And that's something they have to muddle through on their own. As much as I am a biblical literalist, and you know my background, Dallas Theological Seminary, and I hew very closely to those readings, I think my big secret is that I think the Bible is actually a very ambiguous book. Not unclear in what it talks about, but often unclear in what I am supposed to do on a day-to-day basis. The Bible is not going to tell me whether I should buy a Kia or a Honda. If I go to the Bible trying to figure out if I should buy a Kia or a Honda, I'm going to walk away sorely disappointed. And in a lot of these situations like this, I think we really do ourselves a disservice when we say, well, the Bible is going to tell you what your vocation should be in life. Not so much. I don't know that these questions come with a clear right and clear wrong answer. I think there are decisions we have to make, and we make those decisions to the best of our ability, prayerfully and as educated as biblically as we can be. But they're decisions that have to be made. And I know that probably ruffles feathers, right? Because just give you an example, where I grew up in the mountains of Appalachia, where Christianity is very cultural and every day really is sort of lived in this kind of Flannery O'Connor story, there is a sort of tacit expectation that the kids grow up, might go off to college for a bit, but at the end of the day, they're going to end up back in the small town they grew up in, close to their family in a tightly knit community. I mean, all of my extended family members and even my more immediate family members, they all live on top of each other. I call it compound living. They all live in the same holler, two houses down from each other on the same hillside type stuff. And on a superficial level, it's very quaint. right? Oh, how nice it would be to have all my family that close, right? That's the kind of stuff that I'll sometimes hear. Yeah, in your dreams. I mean, that's the stuff that Thomas Kincaid made a killing playing on, the sentimental drivel. No, the truth is you get tired of seeing those same faces that know how to press your buttons, and your drunk cousins always hanging around looking for something to steal. And we all know this one's daughter or son is a meth head, but for the sake of keeping the peace, nobody says anything about it, and we all have to humor them. So I ran. I ran so hard and so fast from that, and I have less than no desire to go back. And it really is sort of comical to me that nobody where I'm from can seem to figure out why I don't want to go back there. But I've learned over the years that my experience, as weird as it can be sometimes, really isn't that unique. That's most people's story to some degree. And what I've learned is that it's the clustering up that always leads to problems. My aunt, I was just talking with her about this. We were talking about another member of the family who, this is the unpredictable one, right? That you never know what's going to happen with this person. And my aunt says this other member of the family, you know, is a fully grown woman with the mind of a 12-year-old. And my point in bringing that up is to say this: when children are not allowed to grow up, when parents refuse to let them go, that is not love. Though it's often construed that way, and I see that in my own family all the time, that is selfishness, plain and simple. And what I see more often than not in those situations are parents who inadvertently cripple their children emotionally and psychologically, even if in their own minds they have the best of motivations. And I think Coda as a film really does explore facets of that in interesting ways. I mean, you see the tension of Ruby saying, you know, you people exhaust me. She tells her parents that at one point in the movie. Like, I can't keep doing this. And I'm sitting there watching it going, yeah, I get that completely. And her mom, especially, played by the wonderful Marley Matlin. I think she's the youngest actress ever to win an Academy Award and the only deaf one as well. I hope I don't get those wrong, but I know it's one of those, maybe both of them.
No, I think Tatum and O'Neill was the youngest actress to ever win it. Didn't she win an Academy Award? I think so. Maybe. For Paper Moon. I don't know. I'm going off the top of my head.
Yeah, nobody Marley Matlin has something. That's kind of the same way. Don't quote me on this. I know she won an Academy Award for something unique, or maybe two or something like that. But she plays the mom who just doesn't get it. And, you know, she has that, which is interesting, right? Because the mom is actually very insightful. As much as she's overbearing and sort of just wants to keep everybody at home, she has that really good line. I think you and I were talking about it before the interview at one point, but she looks at her daughter and says, "If I was blind, would you want to paint?" And it's a zinger of a line. It's a killer line that really isn't wrong. I mean, Ruby does want to separate from her parents, and singing is the thing that separates her from her parents, but her mom is also misjudging her motivations a little bit. But that is a kind of tension that I really understand and really lean into, because I went into what I went into. People say, well, how did you get into, you know, Bible college and things like that? And I half jokingly say, oh, I did it out of rebellion, but I'm actually like half telling the truth when I say that. So I get it. And I thought Coda did a very good job of leaning into that aspect of it and separation and all that.
Well, a few months ago, you talked about Genesis 2 and just that whole idea of leaving and cleaving. I mean, the context of that is, you know, creation and having this family, man and a woman, and Jesus affirming that in the New Testament and says, well, you know, a man will leave his family and cleave to his wife. But, you know, Christianity today, whether it's like you were telling us your story of your experience in Appalachia, but that probably could be not a different experience, like you said, some of the beats in this film, from kids who grow up in upper middle class families who just have this expectation. Their parents are very helicopter like, you know, they plan their children's schedules, they expect them to do certain things and be involved in certain activities. And then there is this expectation, I think, kind of, I would say, you know, I'm a parent myself, just this American dream type of expectation. My kids are going to, you know, let's say you live in a big city, even my kids are going to grow up and they're going to go to college and they're going to meet somebody nice and then they're going to get married and then they're going to come back here and then they're going to live in town with me so that we can do all the holidays together and I can, you know, help look after the grandchildren. There's this kind of idea that, you know, the biblical view of the family would include these typical American beats that probably came to us from Leave It to Beaver or some other such show that's not realistic. So how do you think that this stereotype came into being? I mean, that's just my thoughts on, you know, there's just this idea of the, you know, American family that was perpetuated in maybe film or whatever it is in culture, or maybe it was in Life magazine or whatever it is. And then that's kind of stayed with us so that it's become almost synonymous with a Christian worldview that these things would happen. Not that we affirm the family, which we do, but that the way that it plays out in terms of expectations for children have come to be a little bit more American than Christian.
Yeah, it's the idea of the white picket fence, you know, two kids and a dog in the yard type stuff. And I think it's the stereotype. I think it's like any cliche, it becomes a cliche or a stereotype because there is a shred of truth to it. And you call it the American ideal. I come from Appalachia. We are hillbillies through and through. And I often tell people I come from the place where we do nothing to break the stereotype. Because it's true, we don't. And the reason I think some of this stuff sort of gets folded in with Christianity, especially in America, America is, at least the early ideas of the country, is a very idealized sort of thing. And in Christianity, this is something I have found in my own life, in my own teaching and working with guys, especially coming out of prison, I noticed this. And then sort of contrasting that against like maybe what you call the white middle class experience, a Christian experience in America, is that Christians in America especially, who have not known discomfort, I'll say it that way, tend to sort of go for the ideal. And I need to be very careful how I say this so I'm not misunderstood. They tend to go for the ideal in a way that doesn't recognize that we live in a world that is not ideal. And what's interesting to me is that the Bible certainly presents an ideal situation. But the Bible also understands, the writers of Scripture also understand that the world isn't ideal. That's why they present the ideal. And so much of the biblical narrative is built on hope. And what I see a lot of Christians sort of doing inadvertently is they go for the ideal and they then apply that standard to everybody. And I don't think that holds water at all. You can't sort of reverse engineer a marriage that is broken and has been broken for years. The damage has been done. For example, there's a way of, I don't want to say move on. I hate that word. I hate that expression. It's so passive and just like you shrug things off that you can't shrug off. The damage is done and you have to deal with that. You have to deal with it. That's the kind of stuff that Jesus wants you to deal with, and he wants you to take it to him. That's like the whole point of Christianity. And Christian parents, I think, the reason the stereotype of sort of like the overbearing Christian parent is there is because there's some truth to it. Christian parents can tend to be that way. And I don't think that's damning to admit. I think it's just honest. And for whatever reason, in American culture, Christian parents are often portrayed as very overbearing. And a lot of that comes out of fundamentalism, sure. And fundies, of which I am one, so I absolutely have room to talk, are usually really guilty of this kind of thing. That's the truth to it. The cliche is a thing because the cliche is to a degree true. There is a kernel of truth in there. But I will say this, now that I've harped on, you know, my own people, overbearing fundamentalists are a far cry from many sentimental evangelicals, and I would rather take an overbearing parent than a sentimentalist any day of the week and twice on Sunday. And that's usually because an overbearing parent is coming across as overly protective, like you said, the helicopter mom. And there is a very strong sense of concern there that I think comes from a place of love. With sentimentalism, love is mawkish. It's syrupy. It's not real. There's not a shred of reality to it. It doesn't have teeth. Both are, in some sense, extremes. But I do think that being overbearing is definitely the lesser evil in this case. And I think that the picture of an overbearing Christian that comes to my mind is my dad's mom, my grandmother. Her name was Hazel. She's since passed on, but my dad still tells stories about how she would like walk down the holler and drag him out of the gym if he wasn't home at a certain time. And it was very hard for him growing up. And I've seen over the years the kind of influence that has had on my dad, even in little ways. And this is where the stuff that, like, as the grandson and the son, it grinds on you. I mean, I cannot hang up the phone without my dad telling me to look both ways at an intersection. And that's weird. Like, I understand that that's profoundly weird, right? And I think he does too. Like, it's just an odd thing to say. But what people on the outside looking in probably wouldn't realize, that that's just how my father is. And he's been that way for as long as I've known him, you know, 20, 27 years. And I have friends who be like, dude, you're nearly 30. Your dad's still telling you how to drive. Yeah, that's just, that's how he is. And that's how the family is. And yes, it can get annoying, but you learn to manage it. You learn to manage it and you learn to deal with it. And this is where that separation comes in. You deal with that in the best way you can, and you learn to find those areas where you can separate and be your own person, and you manage it, and that's that.
I think one thing that was interesting about this film to me was, on the one hand, you know, there's the parents who have putting this huge responsibility on her, you know, for the family business and everything. But on the other hand, I will say this film is rated PG-13, and listeners will hear in an upcoming episode, we are going to talk about a different film with a different writer called Grace and Grit, based on a true story. And that was rated R, and I have no idea why. I mean, they said the F word a couple of times, but this one has a lot of like explicit sexual banter type of thing, and it's PG-13. So I'm just saying, if that would be hard for people to watch, it is kind of has that. But some of that takes place in her actual family. And what is interesting is, even though they have their particular moments or their, you know, particular conflicts, they love one another. And that's one of the other teenagers says, hey, you know, after some like kind of weird bullying kind of thing, you know, but I've always really admired your family. And she doesn't know why. And it's because he says, your parents love each other. He's like, my parents, they're still married, but they can't even stand each other. And so that's really interesting. It shows a portrait of a marriage that's been going on for a long time, where the parents are still, you know, in love with one another. And so there's that aspect to it that I think shows family in a positive way that's different than normal, than your normal, you know, you kind of see the suburban kind of family where they go through, after so many decades, they're just kind of drifting farther apart type of thing.
Yeah, that is something I noticed too, and something I actually really appreciated about this film, that where many other films would probably have tried to throw in this subplot about the parents going through a rocky marriage, you don't see that at all. This is a working class family. Sure, they're disabled in one sense of the word, but they're a working class family who never once is it sort of even hinted at that, oh my gosh, is this going to split the family apart? No. No. And their strength in marriage ultimately gets them through the whole separation process. And I think that's how things are supposed to go. You see that really, really wonderful scene where it's a very quiet and quick scene between the mom and the dad, but the mom comes into the bedroom and she's talking about Ruby. And she's like, you know, can you believe this? And she's like, you know, that's my baby. And the husband, her husband, the dad is like, but she's not, she's not a baby anymore. And it's the dad who really uses her for the fishing business. That's the thing. She really is his lifeline to so much. It makes life so much easier in one sense for him. He's the one who has to really come to terms with sort of letting her go. And he sort of helps get her mom through that. And it really is a very good picture, as you've said, of a family functioning in the way that families are supposed to function, especially in these matters.
So do you think, first of all, should Christians watch Coda? Can they watch it? And I would say, you know, with the caveat of what we just said as to why it was PG-13. And can they watch it if they're comfortable with that? Can they watch it and discover something about themselves or about a Christian worldview?
Sure. I'm always hesitant to tell someone, yeah, you should watch this movie as a personal thing. So I don't know that they should watch it. Can they watch it? Sure. It was C.S. Lewis, I think, who talked about the purpose of stories being to teach us empathy for others. It also helps us to slot ourselves behind the eyes of other people and walk around in their skin for a little while, see the world from other perspectives. And that's really true, I think. So yeah, I think if nothing else, a Christian can watch Coda and come out with a new perspective, maybe on just the hearing impaired. There are several really, really powerful moments in the movie that do this incredibly well. And you mentioned one of them. And it was when Ruby is sort of singing and the camera shifts to her father's perspective. So you're with her. It's a really well done and just well filmed scene and edited incredibly well, where the viewer is subtly shifted around to her father's perspective and the sound just fades. And it's really beautiful and a really powerful moment. And then when he asks her to sing for him when they're by themselves and he can't hear her, but he presses his hand to her throat just to feel her vocal cords vibrating. That's such a weirdly intimate but very powerful scene. So yeah, I think you can watch it and come away with a new perspective, you know, and if you really, really want to dig into it, Christians can watch it and come out with a new perspective, maybe on parenting. Or if you're afraid that you might be that overbearing parent, watch it and see if you can gauge how your kids are responding to you based on how Ruby and Leo respond to their parents. So there's a good bit to be gleaned from this film. So like you said, bearing in mind the caveat that there is some really sort of unexpectedly graphic language used, it's something that can be seen and enjoyed and dug into.
And interestingly, it's done by the parents. It's not, I don't think it's really done by the teenagers as much as the parents. Well, for something different, I'm going to, as per usual, so not that different, ask some fun rapid fire questions for Cole. Cole, is there a new place that you visited recently?
A new place that I visited recently. I went to Dodge City earlier in the year, first time.
And besides your family, what's the best part of your life right now?
The best part of my life right now? Oh my gosh. I'm done with school. And so that's kind of nice. It's probably a terrible thing to say, but I am very glad to be done.
Well, this doesn't have to be a heavy statement, but fill in the blank. I've had enough of...
school, I said, but for today, coffee. We're switching to water. It's 2 o'clock where I am.
Well, thank you for being a guest again on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Thank you so much. It's always good to be here.
You've been listening to episode 251 of the Postmodern Realities podcast, which is brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest has been Cole Burgett. He has written an online exclusive film review of this film, Coda, which is on Apple TV or it's available to rent. And his film review is called Growing Up and Letting Go in Coda. All of our subscribers to our print magazine can access it on our website for free. But if you're not a subscriber and would like to start reading these online exclusive articles and reviews, please subscribe to our journal at equip.org. We'd like to connect to you, so please subscribe to the Bible Answer Man YouTube channel and join in the conversation in the comment section and in the live chat when we have premiere videos. Please follow the Bible Answer Man page on Facebook and on Twitter. You will find us at Hank Hanegraaff, Bible Answer Man, Christian Research Institute, and Christian Research Journal, as well as on Instagram at the Bible Answer Man account. You won't want to miss every Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern when we live stream the Bible Answer Man broadcast, hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff at our website, equip.org. In addition, please subscribe to the Hank Unplugged podcast. Hank gets out of the studio and into his study and engages in in-depth, free-flowing, essential Christian conversations on critical issues with some of the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people on the planet. You'll want to head on over to equip.org because there you're going to find thousands of free resources for you in articles and past broadcasts, our podcasts, and videos. And thank you for all the ways in which you partner with the Christian Research Institute.